You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mike Wallace and Carmen Bayosa on their book, Narco History, How the U.S. and Mexico Jointly Created the Mexican Drug War. Also on the program, a preview, tomorrow's oral arguments at the Supreme Court of the United States that could very well put the final nail in the coffin to those who have a problem with marriage equality in this country. Also on the program today, right-wing media hook, line, sinker, fishing pole, boat, ocean. They swallowed all of it in their quest to come up with a story about Harry Reid. And also, fallout from that meeting that Ted Cruz had with a gay hotelier. The hotelier has regret, and Ted Cruz is calling liberals fascists. And the heartwarming story of how pharmaceutical industry, they're really in the business of just buying up patents and jacking up the price. Well, at least that's a big part of their business. And Aaron's law introduced in the Senate. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just a little bit of house cleaning before we go to this interview. We have 4 days left on our Indiegogo campaign, and it's gone great. We hit our goal within a couple of weeks. We only have 4 days left, and I mentioned this. If you obviously, I don't want to say don't contribute. We would love more contributions. We definitely have plenty to do here and plenty of plans with any extra funds. But I mentioned this only because it was very late to put up this perk, but it is the original Marin V. Cedar hours, putting up 5 episodes. I'm still editing them. It was a video show. And I suppose you could just listen to it as audio. Maybe we can make it available just as audio only, but I don't know. Where I was sitting upstate in a studio, and Marin was sitting in his kitchen in L.A. And I believe it was like 2007 to 2008. Maybe it was just the first half of 2008 when we were both in sort of Air America exile, more or less. And Marin, of course, was still in his sort of like depressive phase. He had just started WTF, and I think that was going fairly well at that time, but he had, you know, literally 5%, 10% of the audience he has now. And so, to be honest with you, I haven't listened to him. So I don't even know how entertaining or not, but for longtime listeners, you may be interested in it. And we're just offering it for $40. It's not bad. $8 a show, I guess. But it's also a way to contribute to this program. So I just want to make you aware of that. You can go to themajorityreport.com. Of course, all the other ways of supporting this program continue. Become a member if you can afford it. And if you can't, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out with you. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And free shipping lasts for another 3 days. So I would get on that as well. And, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, make sure you do this. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap from there. You only have to do it once. You won't even notice the difference. But we get a little kickback. Every little bit helps. And that's something that's just like a no-brainer. If you're doing it already, why not skim some of Jeff Bezos's profits and put it in our pockets? All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Wallace and Carmen Boyosa. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, I'd like to welcome to the program Mike Wallace, a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York, and Carmen Boyosa, an author of 15 novels on their latest book, a Narco History, How the United States and Mexico Jointly Created the Mexican Drug War. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us on, Sam.
So let's start with the beginnings of the origins of what you refer to as Mexico's drug violence, because you also make the argument it's not really a war insofar as that it's difficult to sort of contemplate who the two sides are, I guess, on some level. But what were the very early origins of this Mexican drug war?
Well, let's see. I mean, there's two pieces to this. One of them is what people tend to think of, which is the last 10 years, somewhere around 2004, violence really spiraled up and out of control. But our argument is that the roots of this current bloodbath, in fact, go way back. I mean, there's been this tendency to, I mean, there are now people in the streets by the tens, hundreds of thousands, protesting the current president of Mexico on the grounds that they're not protecting the citizenry from all of this violence. And in fact, police forces and military are actually committing some of it. But they did the same thing and called for the ouster of the previous president and the president before that. And our argument is that while you have to look at the specific situation and the specific political players, you've got to step back a bit and see that the roots of this thing are in the development of a situation where right now something like 90% of meth, heroin, coke, marijuana flows from Mexico to the U.S. Billions of dollars flow back in the opposite direction. Huge numbers of guns and armaments and Kalashnikovs and all that are flowing south as well, fueling the violence. And that this state of affairs itself dates back a century to the development of a prohibition regime that criminalized the use of various drugs in the U.S. and Mexico as well. And that everything that's followed, and there have been prior incidents of violence, have been a spin-off of this larger state of affairs. And so at the end of the book, we come back to the question and say, really, you can't solve this issue by changing presidents or the political system, although that may be important, but you have to, in fact, reverse the prohibition regime that was set in place 100 years ago. That's in the super nutshell what we're focusing on.
And I want to come back to sort of what the appropriate response is. But let me ask you, when you say 90% of the 90% of the drugs flowing, are you saying 90% of that is
used in the U.S.?
Okay.
Mexico is the super supplier. It wasn't always that case. You know, it was the Colombians were crucial players in terms of direct provision, but that's changed. And so everything now has been flowing up from Mexico.
Now, let me ask you, what percentage, do we have a sense of what percentage of the Mexican, let's say, product is used in the United States? I mean, in other words, 90% of what we use comes from Mexico.
It's transshipped. I mean, there's still cocaine is better grown farther south, and sort of it comes up through Mexican drug routes. Whereas heroin, I mean, opium poppies and marijuana plants are flourish in Mexican soil directly.
And as about meth, Mexico has labs fabricating it, but many of the ingredients do come from China. So it is an international, it's not an operation that you can pin only on one country. The coke leaves are not planted in Mexico. Let's say that Mexico has become, unfortunately, the center of operations of the drug. It's not only the drug shipping company, but it's also the center of the whole operations. They collect it, finish some of its procedures, and then send it.
So Mexico, in many respects, has become sort of the processing plant.
Yes, when the Congress in 2004 outlawed bulk sales of pseudoephedrine, which was a precursor chemical for meth, labs sprang up in the hills of Guerrero because it was right near the port of Lázaro Cárdenas, where they imported tankers worth full of the drugs, which in fact were outlawed in the States. So it's this intricate dance, this kind of perverse symbiosis between the two countries that's the problem.
And so if Mexico becomes that sort of that processing plant, I mean, do they, is any drugs that are manufactured there, are they exported anywhere else besides the U.S.?
Yes, of course, but the main market is here.
Okay.
This is the biggest market. The biggest amount of users are here, and they pay back with the worst possible product. that on our book we call the River of...
The Iron River.
The Iron River.
Well, it's guns are just another source of profit, but they're also, once they cross the border, they're weapons that feed the killing grounds.
All right. Well, let's go. I mean, so we're back in the early 1900s, and then in 1909 and 1914, where we have a drug criminalization in this country. Then take us forward in time as to the different, attempts by both the U.S. and Mexico to deal with these cross-border shipments?
1909 is the anti-smoking opium law, which was aimed directly at Chinese who were getting white women drugged and turning them into sex slaves. And Coke also had this kind of ethnic thing. The argument was that black men in the South get coked up and go out and rape white women. Marijuana, interestingly, wasn't included on the list of criminalized products until later in the 30s.
It was first criminalized in Mexico, also for a class race reason. It was the drug, by the way, it's not original from Mexico. It originally came from the other side of the ocean. The pre-Hispanic Mexico did not cultivate nor have any contact with marijuana. So marijuana came with the Spaniards because of the hemp. They needed it for the ropes of the boats, and it had an important use. It was very useful besides the other use we all know.
So in Mexican, during the Mexican Revolution, marijuana was considered the most dangerous possible plant, but it was largely because it too was associated with ethnic groups, Indians and poor people. So the new modern Mexico was going to transcend all that and outlaw these reliance on drugs. Interestingly, getting back to your question, it was in the 1930s that the U.S. criminalizes marijuana at the same time that Mexico decides under the Cardenas regime that it's going to, in fact, abandon the punitive approach, and it's going to set up public health approach, and it's going to have harm reduction, and it's going to have clinics that are available to people. And the U.S., in the person of Harry Anslinger, who is the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, who had been think Reefer Madness movie from the mid-1930s, had drummed up support for criminalizing marijuana. And then he discovers that Mexico is breaking ranks, and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics had the legal authority to outlaw, to de-permit the exportation of drugs, medicines, and so forth. So Anslinger got on the horn to Mexico and said, if you don't reverse this project and if you don't go back to the criminalization approach, we're going to cut you off without penicillin and everything else.
Wow.
And so, in fact, they folded. And there have been several other times where Mexico was the reluctant partner in this. I mean, one of the more bizarre ones was in the Nixon era. Nixon, remember, denounces marijuana as public enemy number one and declares war on drugs. He's the guy that sets up the DEA. And he starts leaning on Mexico to do aerial spraying of marijuana and poppy plants. And Mexico, looking at what's happening in Vietnam, says, well, we're not crazy about this idea. So G. Gordon Liddy of Watergate fame comes up with the notion of sending thousands of inspectors to the Mexico-U.S. border and searching every car, every baby carriage, every woman's purse, until the frontier grounds to a complete halt. And he makes it clear that only if Mexico undertakes an escalation of the anti-drug program will the border be reopened. And once again, in fact, it was. And then in the 1980s, Reagan administration is the time when the certification program is passed, which says that if Mexico doesn't play ball, if Mexico doesn't do as much drug fighting as we up here think they should be doing, then all foreign aid will be cut off, and all petitions of Mexico to international financial agencies like the IMF will be opposed by the U.S., which is, of course, the kiss of death.
So, so place into context for us where it is in the 1980s where we sort of move into, I guess, the beginning of the modern era of this this drug war, where we see the development, I guess, of the first is the Guadalajara cartel.
Cartel, which is a clustering of several of the leading growers of marijuana and opium, they come together. And they're called really by the DEA, the Guadalajara cartel, picking up on the Colombia cartel notion. But the 80s is also when coke goes big in the U.S. And these guys become first the FedEx service, really, for Colombian cartels, and then they take over the business directly. And it's at that point that they grow to such spectacularly large, rich levels that they transform the nature of the industry. It's the violence levels are relatively curtailed because the Mexican state, although officially following the U.S. script, is in fact profoundly corrupted like U.S. agencies were during Prohibition times. And they enter into this symbiotic underground relationship with the cartel, and they protect the cartel, and they ward off competitors, and they, in effect, you know, regularize the flow of narcotics, and huge amounts of money go into bribes to governors, to local police forces, and so forth.
It's the times where in Mexico there's only one political party that runs the whole country and all the states. So that kind of control was in a way vertical, because there was one president and all the governors of all the states belonged to the same party and to the same pyramid, to the same vertical order.
So what happens in the 80s and then the early 90s is that the cartel, partly because they arrest after a particularly outrageous torture and murder of a DEA agent who had been captured and killed. The response to that is that the U.S. really demands the arrest of the leaders of the Guadalajara cartel, and they get it. After which, the cartel splits. And because there's now billions of dollars at stake, basically they get into a competitive frenzy. And that competitive frenzy gets worse throughout the 90s and into the zeros.
Aggravated by the political situation in Mexico. We no longer have the one-party rule. Now, at least we have three parties that are main players. The governors receive more independent budget from the federation and also from illegal sources. So they become allies of different groups of narcos. We are a little bit uncomfortable with the word cartels.
So it's, the end of the reign of the PRI, which had been in power for 70 years, was a good thing. Carmen was one of the people who were involved in movements to, in fact, get them out of power. But the division now in the state meant that you didn't have a unified state capable of controlling things, and you didn't have a unified single cartel that was running things. And basically, when the federal government decides to attack the problem by sending the army into a full-scale assault on various cities, it's like spraying gasoline on a fire and all hell breaks loose. And it's not a tidy war between the state and the criminals. There's umpteen fragments of states and umpteen fragments of criminals, and all of this is fed by a huge increase in the flow of guns coming south.
Before we get to sort of that, to where we are in history, I want to go back to just sort of this concept of gasoline on this fire, because in the 80s, to a certain extent, some of that gasoline was in the form of the I guess ultimately the covert war against the Sandinistas.
Yes.
And just tell us what during that period of the early 80s, to what extent our war against the Sandinistas, like I say, undeclared, was sort of added that fuel to this sort of increasing or soon to be increasing violence.
Yes, you've got a crazy situation. You've got the DEA is dedicated to shutting down criminal operations outside Mexico. But you've got the CIA, which in Reagan time trumps the anti-drug warriors, making use of the drug runners here. They give money to the Contras. They provide training camps for the Contras. So you've got this schizoid division now inside the U.S., which feeds the division inside the country.
And as in many other corners of this story, also they thread Mexican contribution. It's the inner American division, to say so, but also a Mexican contribution. And it was during the 70s, the supposed drug against wars, against the war against drugs, was also used politically to erase towns, complete towns, that had people that were upheavaled against the state, the guerrilleros of Guerrero. The state of Guerrero, they were totally wiped in by an operation also called Operation Condor, like in South America, to eliminate all political disturbance or political rebels of Mexico.
And and so has that dynamic, I mean, I want to go back to sort of like the 90s and what the implications of NAFTA had on this as well. But has that dynamic where the use of the drug war as a mechanism to attack political enemies? I mean, we recently had this horrible story of 43 students killed. And I know that wasn't necessarily the drug war was not a fig leaf, but in some ways the relationships that were built as a function of this sort of narco state ended up sort of, I guess, providing the mechanism to kill those students. But how much has that sort of commingled?
I think it's more than providing a mechanism. I think that an intelligent machinery of death has been built. Death and destruction. And it's that same machinery that has packed the American jails with Afro-Americans and Hispanics. I think this drug war does have a political edge everywhere, involuntary probably, but it's an intelligent machinery.
But there's a specific connection. I mean, we speculate on this, but you know, the military were on the scene when this massacre of the 43 students took place and basically did nothing. And we couldn't help but notice that one of the graduates of the Ayotzinapa school for teacher training had been a fellow named Cabanas, who had been, in fact, one of the guerrilla leaders who had been up in the hills and who the army had been trying for years to catch back in the 70s. They eventually did. They eventually killed him. And memories are long, so it's not totally impossible that the military remembered this and had a particular animus against this collection of radical students. But as to whether or not it's the same level of things, probably not, because in those days, when they sent up into Michoacán and Guerrero, they sent 10, 20, 30,000 troops. It was a full-scale armed assault. And Cabañas and other guerrillas, in fact, managed to escape them for years because they had a lot of popular support in the countryside. So, I mean, the countryside issue is where, in fact, it dovetails with your NAFTA question. I mean, we don't want to overdo this. You can't pin everything on NAFTA. But the combination of NAFTA together with the neoliberal so-called reforms that were started by the De La Madrid regime and then carried on by Salinas, and a lot of this was under pressure, but also from true belief that the government was too big, that business had to be freed, and so forth. But the consequences of the dismantling of the program of supports for small farmer agriculture were that enormous numbers of people from the countryside were forced off the land. They simply couldn't survive in this new free market and competition with agribusiness competition coming in from the U.S. And some of them went up to the maquiladora plants along the Mexican border. Some of them concentrated in slums in Mexico City. But a fair number of them, thousands and thousands, moved into the narco economy. Because, I mean, the NAFTA people don't like to think about this, but as part of the process of modernization with automobile plants and so forth, well, the narco industry, which for a time there was bringing in more money than any other sector of the economy, is also part of the new Mexico. And it's just that it's an underground part. So we think that NAFTA and the neoliberal drive of the 80s and 90s acted as an accelerant, but the forces that were, in fact, underpinning all of this was this kind of perverse symbiosis between the drug users in the States and the drug sellers in Mexico.
Plus, the army of untrained young people in Mexico, the state cuts have helped feed thousands and thousands of Mexicans who have absolutely no training of any kind, no education or training, and they are there to be enrolled by the thugs or by the state in the army to be enrolled into this absolutely crazy war, to call it that way.
And we should say, in terms of NAFTA, you know, we have a situation where as much as people like to call it free trade, this is all subsidized corn that's going into Mexican markets, right? I mean, in this country, we subsidize corn significantly. It's going and it's undercutting, essentially wiping out a lot of sort of the more rural agriculture. And so you have, I guess what you're describing here is a lot of raw material in terms of young campesinos who then go into the military. They come out of the military, they have no prospects but for this industry, essentially, that values highly trained paramilitary.
Or they, in fact, actually straddle and transfer their allegiance. So Los Zetas, which is arguably, it's hard to choose, the most vicious and depraved and murderous of the cartels that emerged in the 90s, were originally special forces, part of the Mexican army, and trained some of them in the United States in counterterrorism. And some of them were sent down to Chiapas to deal with the uprising of the campesinos down there in response to NAFTA in particular. And then they realized they could make a hell of a lot more money by working with the Gulf cartel, and they became their kind of Praetorian Guard, their military wing. And then once they militarized, well, then in El Chapo and the Sinaloa people, they militarize. And there's this constant tit-for-tat increase in levels of violence and in levels of horror. I mean, you know, we've sort of almost gone back to war again because several people were beheaded in the Middle East. Well, according to Reforma, one of the most respected newspapers who was tracking this during the last 10 years, of the bare minimum 100,000 people who died in the last 10 years, and it's almost certainly considerably more than that, arguably 2,000 of them died by being beheaded. Often, in fact, videotapes were made of the process itself and put up online. Yes, I mean, at the height of the horror in roughly 2008, 2009, 2010, particularly in Ciudad Juarez, which became the most murderous place on the planet for a while, It's this war of everybody against everybody, and police are fired, and then they switch sides and join the drug lords, and it's just a descent into hell, if ever the term meant anything. That's where it's.
There's two things I want to touch on perhaps where that sort of most extreme violence has migrated, perhaps south on some level. But before we get there, also tell us the implications of, I think it was 2003, the ban on assault weapons in this country expired. The AR-15, I think it is, became available. That had major implications, didn't it?
Yeah, this was passed in 94 by the Clinton administration. And it limited semi-automatic weapon production. It was due to expire in 2004. Interestingly, public opinion polls showed something like 80%+ of the population wanted to extend it, including, interestingly, then-President George Bush. But Tom DeLay, the leader of the right-wing insurgency in the Republican Party, in conjunction with the NRA, managed to kill that extension. So consequently, all wraps were off, and there was now a flood of armaments pouring south at just the moment that, in fact, the levels of violence inside Mexico are accelerating. And it's not a coincidence.
And so, I mean, is your sense that, I mean, you said that 2010 was the high water mark for violence in Mexico, and Juarez was sort of the one of the most violent cities in the world.
It were so. The problem is that, well, two things. You had mentioned the violence moving south. Ciudad Juarez is in fact now quiet. This happens a lot. These flip flops, largely depending on who wins in the particular battle between drug lords and the state.
But Tamaulipas is north, and it's still in turmoil.
Exactly.
It's not as easy as saying when it's moved south.
Right. It's moved south, and it's moved east, and it's moved west. So Michoacan is a mess. Guerrero is a mess. Tamaulipas, we just read a story yesterday. It's now become routine that when you hear the automatic rifles starting to shoot, school children know that they are to duck beneath their desks, sort of duck and cover in the new Mexican style. So yes, the trouble is that you can't think only in terms of face-offs between state and cartels. What's happened is, partly because, in fact, there have been a lot of captures of top capos. But when you de-head a cartel, it splits. The Hydra principle comes into operation. And then you get 3, 4, 5, 6 competing cartels, which the level of violence can go up. Or if, in fact, it's too crowded, the drug business itself, what's happened is the development of collateral criminality. So kidnapping has exploded in Mexico, as has extortion. And Mexico is arguably the kidnap capital of the world now. So violence changes its nature as well as its level.
Is that, I mean, because I want to move into sort of, you know, what can be done at this point. But is that that sort of migration of of kidnapping exploding, is that still a function? Could that exist in and of itself? In other words, as I ask you about what needs to change to begin to at least trend down the violence and the problems with narcotics in Mexico. Does those sort of ancillary criminal enterprises still remain, or are they sort of still sort of perching on the foundation of the drug war?
I think it's both. There are a lot of loners who get into the business, but at the other end, some of the biggest kidnappers are the most organized, the Zetas. Partly, they have professionalized in kidnapping in gross lots, particularly of migrants coming up from Central America, riding the trains, and they're kidnapped by the hundreds, by the Zetas. Also, it turns out that in the last couple of years, there have been freelancers who now are calling themselves, either with permission, paid for, or more riskily on their own, they're calling themselves Zetas. Because if you go into a town and you terrify people by just announcing the Zetas have arrived, they're not going to check your credentials, it'll be easier to get money out of them. And also, extortion is now, it's not just mom-and-pop stores, although there's tons of that, but mining corporations, Canadian mining corporations, have been waylaid. Iron mining in the Michoacan area. So corporations themselves are being attacked. So one doesn't know whether, if in fact somehow or another, the biggest operations were crushed, whether that would mean that the little guys would wither on the vine, or criminality now as a way of life is so profound and so forth.
I think corruption is there also, part of the same situation, because there's this real immense waves of money, and the government officials, many of them, have been corrupted. So you have to understand that, we all have to understand that this would not exist without the collaboration of government officials of both sides of the border. Returning to the kidnapping, the kidnappers don't act totally alone. They have to have allies inside the government. They have to have an umbrella to operate. So if those umbrellas are destroyed, they won't be able to operate, because people are not passive. They don't want this to happen. So you would have the civil order returning.
And if, in fact, there was a move to arrest people, highly unlikely given that many of the police and federal police are bought and sold, then you turn them over to the judiciary. And the judiciary is corrupt beyond belief. And the jails are functioning agents of various narco operators. So, but your question is, you know, what is to be done at the grosser level, at least? And there, it's a very complicated story. But I think that decriminalization is essential. It's the billions of dollars that are flowing down. If they could be cut in some significant amount, then there's less money to bribe governors, there's less money to buy police departments, there's less money to buy Kalashnikovs and so forth. We've already seen that with Colorado and the other decriminalized states in the United States, they have already changed the ballgame dramatically, not sufficiently, but dramatically. The price...
Have you changed the ballgame for Mexico? Is that change being felt in Mexico?
Yes.
Because the surge of marijuana production, because now there are, you know, millions and millions of dollars circling ahead over these various states, waiting to land when the next state opens up. But there's been a huge increase in marijuana production. The price has gone down, and the price, therefore, that marijuana growers in Mexico they've been going down too. And in fact, several of them, I mean, the numbers are hard to quantify, have switched out of marijuana because it just isn't worth the money anymore. Of course, unfortunately, they've switched into poppy production.
Right.
So there's been a surge in cheap heroin imports. So, you know, the one question is the prohibition regime in Mexico sustainable if, in fact, the U.S. regime, at least in marijuana, collapses? If California, as almost certainly will be the case, in the next referendum there on legalization, it seems something like 85% of the population are prepared to say yes, unlike 94 when it was a cliffhanger. If that happens, think about the Mexican military is lined up south of Tijuana, guns pointed south, to defend the United States from marijuana imports. When you turn around and walk across the border 100 yards and they're selling reefer at 7-Eleven stores, you know,
right.
It's not sustainable. So then the question becomes, is it enough to make a real dent in the crime rates in Mexico. And, you know, who knows? And all these numbers are very soft. And so, honestly, the only real solution that would make a tremendous dent would be to decriminalize everything. Follow the Portugal model, follow the Uruguay model. And it's understandable that there's anxieties about this, but they're wildly misplaced. I mean, look at what's legal. Nicotine, tobacco-related deaths last year were 480,000 people died.
Right.
And nobody's talking about criminalizing it again. Alcohol, 88,000 people died last year from alcohol-related.
Yes, but if you criminalize them, you would have even more corpses. That's the logic one has to follow. What has to be done is inform the people, as has been done with tobacco. And whoever wants to continue murdering itself, well...
And heroin overdoses, which have surged by a factor of 3 in the last several years, is still only 8,000 people. And because all of those are people who don't know how to deal with overdoses or needles or so forth, harm reduction, public education programs, which are now impossible because the drug is illegal, would go down. Marijuana deaths last year, according to the CDC, zero. So,
unless you count all the corpses that have died in Mexico.
Yes,
and
of
then
course.
We would have to make the division.
You're
how many of
death.
Those? Yes, exporting death. And that is totally a perverse, to say the least.
Indeed. Mike Wallace, Carmen Biosa, the book is A Narco History, How the United States and Mexico Jointly Created the Mexican Drug War. Thanks so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks a lot for
having us. Bye. All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. I'll also talk about, you know, I teased this a little bit last week. We got an IM about it. And I had mentioned it at some point during last week as well about my daughter as a New York public school student was she wasn't really faced with the question of opting out. I was faced with the question of opting her out of the test that she was scheduled to take this year. She just completed them last week. 1 week of ELA, English Language Arts, I believe it's short for, and then math. And they happened, both of them happened over a three-day period. 60 minutes one day, 60 minutes the next day, 90 minutes on the math. I think the English was 60 minutes 3 days in a row. And I don't know what the tests were. I know what the practice tests look like because we took some practice tests. But there's a growing movement, at least in New York State, and part of the reason may be just because early adopters of Common Core, and also because Andrew Cuomo is hell-bent on privatizing our educational system because Ken Langone has a big fat wallet. I mean, I'm using shorthand here. And so you had almost 8%, 7% of students opting out of the testing regime over the past 2 weeks in a movement that I think, you know, got a little bit of a late start. I mean, it's early in the whole thing, but it's not like this. They've been building for this for a year. This is really only something that I had the first conversations with people less than 2 months ago as a student's parent, I should say. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I mean, I already covered some of it, of why we did what we did with my daughter. But this dynamic is not going away. And I can guarantee you that next year you're going to see more people opting out in this state. And then you're going to see this come to a state, if not your state, in a state near you. It is a fascinating dynamic because there is actually a dynamic where this regime can be sunk because it can literally be made inoperable. Um, That and other stories. We got some sound, if I can find my sound sheet. Here it is. Yeah. Some reaction to the Bruce Jenner interview that took place over the weekend. I'm not going to spend too much time covering it, but it was interesting to me because Michael had no idea. Just a generational divide. Michael had no idea that Bruce Jenner was a decathlon winner.
Oh, no idea that he was
on a Wheaties box and no appreciation of it. Meanwhile, I had no idea that, and I still, the most mystifying thing to me, and I only watched like part of the interview, the most mystifying thing to me about the whole Bruce Jenner thing is like, I don't understand like, what's going on? Like, he's somehow involved with the Kardashians. He was on like a reality show.
Yeah,
his ex-wife was like the producer I'm completely, the only part that's sort of like confusing me about the whole Bruce Jenner thing is like this, his involvement in this whole like TV thing. Like, I had no idea about that. Like, I hear Bruce Jenner, all I think about is the world's greatest athlete when I was a kid and Wheaties box. I had no idea about the other stuff, but we'll talk about that. Also briefly talk about the what is it called? The Hollywood Press Corps or the Washington Press. What is it? The correspondence.
Where Obama is funny.
Yes. But but there was a great piece by Will Bunch. I think it was in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Because, you know, I check out over the weekends. I honestly don't follow much what's going on. And because for me, it's like, you know, Saturday night is it's movie night. And sadly, Myla has fallen in love with Jim Carrey. And it is really, this is a painful period in our household right now.
What movie is he watching?
Oh,
The Mask?
I just wanted to watch Dumb and Dumber. And so like, whatever. If I have to hear, I like it a lot. Again, I'm gonna
somebody stop me.
I'm gonna kill myself. But
can we live tweet it
when I kill myself?
Mm-hmm. Might be a good promotion.
I'll
for
tell
the
you
show.
That Myla will Instagram it.
Matt and Mike Monday.
She wants
Sam's
Majority Report.
Himself.
She wants a Majority Report Instagram account, anyways. That she's claiming she's gonna set up.
That's actually a really good idea.
But
oh my God, Myla.
The point being that there is this White House correspondence dinner and all sorts of other news going on, particularly like in Baltimore. There's obviously massive protests about another killing of an African-American, young African-American man in police custody. Also, this massive earthquake that I don't even know that we know the tally of yet. I mean, last I saw it was about 3,000, but I imagine it's going to continue to grow. And they apparently cable news could not cut away from the White House correspondents did it.
They actually, I was watching CNN as CNN wondered aloud, I wonder if Obama will talk about what happened.
Well, we've got a clip I think, do we have that clip of Errol Lewis? Did you not pull that clip? I sent you that clip.
Of Errol Lewis?
Yes. I guess we didn't get that clip.
No, I never got Errol Lewis.
Yes, I did. Check your IM. It is from Will Bunch's story. It's
mistake.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, indeed. But nevertheless, Will Bunch's story it really speaks to the future of this program in some respects. I mean, that's a little bit myopic. But all right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, read your IMs, take your calls, talk about that stuff. Hopefully. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number to be a part of this program, ladies and gentlemen. If you cannot remember the different ways I outlined to support this program, rewind. Go back to the first 7 minutes of the show where I talked about it, because I just don't have the effort to do it now. And yes, I'm planning on getting a haircut, okay? So for those of you at Sam Cedar YouTube, youtube.com/Sam Cedar, who are making comments about my hair, my unshavenness, That's the way I'm rolling now. It's like I've noticed, like, I'm dragging the no shaving into Mondays now. I'm so it's really just Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday if you want to see me unshaved. And now, and I know I got to get a haircut. I don't have time. Saul is now like entering into a 2s era, and it's becoming. He's got an attitude. That kid's got an attitude. All right, we'll be right back.